Catherine, I know as you were considering your response on this one, you went back and forth a little bit, and you were definitely tempted to take off here. And you would take off in your plane because you have enough familiarity with it to know that it would work out. You also say in your response that a responsible abort point will produce a safe outcome. This is a 2,600-foot runway. The chart says on pavement you'd be off by 1,000 feet. Call it, say, 1,200. If you set an abort point at 1,200, you still have 1,400 feet to stop. What could go wrong there? Why is that not a responsible abort point in this case?
You know, I don't actually see a problem with this. And you're right, I actually did go back and forth on this a bit because, again, I think in this situation, I probably would go ahead and do this. But it's the idea that this pilot is not as sure about his, you know, aircraft performance than I am with mine. And so, you know, the thing is, if you're not confident, you know, I don't think that departing is a good idea. If you set a responsible abort point, and by abort point, I mean when the wheels have left the ground, so the airplane is in the air. And after that point, you know, you're set on that abort point, and if you are not in the air by that point, you are going to retard the throttle and you have enough room to bring the aircraft to a stop. I actually don't see anything wrong with that. You know, it's the idea that the pilot isn't sure if the plane is going to be off the ground. And, you know, these friends he's brought to this event, it's the idea that this is part of an experiment, but that experimenting really should have gone on in the past so that that person, the pilot, understands, you know, what the POH predicts and how close the airplane is to achieving those predictions. You know, a few years ago, just as a quick example, I sent one of my airplanes its engine off for overhaul. And when it came back, my airplane was achieving over twice the climb rate than it did with the, you know, with the worn out engine. So the thing is, you know, the same POH, though, is supposed to predict the performance for both of those airplanes. And it's just, it can be fantasy. So, you know, again, I think if the pilot had enough experience connecting the POH predictions to actual performance and felt confident about this, I don't see anything wrong with setting an abort point and going ahead and doing it.
Yeah, but as you said, the abort point should be an anomaly detector, sort of, right? There's something wrong here. You don't want the pilot to be rolling down the runway thinking maybe, 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 and then at the last second, it's either high-speed abort or go for it, right?
Exactly. Right. It's for the anomalies, you know, I left the carb heat on, or, you know, it's for those sorts of situations, not for guesswork.
Dave, you're going to go for it. You're number three, but with the caveat. What is it?
Yeah, I would go with a partial load. I would get maybe one or two passengers, plan on taking them to a nearby airport and doing a separate trip. To get the remaining passengers. Catherine's right about the book values. You know, the POH is sort of written by the marketing department, not the engineering department. And, you know, it's shocking sometimes when you plot out expected performance and then see the actual performance and it doesn't even come close. You know, in just sort of penciling this out, it seems like, okay, hard surface runway, airplane ought to be off in 1,000 feet. You know, the Cirrus manual, I know this isn't, we're not flying a Cirrus, but it's an airplane of similar size and weight. It says a grass runway, add 20%. A wet grass runway, add 30%. So if you were to add to 30%, then you'd still be off at 1,300 feet or midfield on a 2,600-foot runway. You know, normally that would be enough, but as we just mentioned, I don't trust the POH. So I think a fairly conservative way to do this would be to set midfield as an abort point, take one or two passengers to a nearby paved runway, come back for the other passenger or two, and then do it that way. I think that, you know, that would seem like a reasonable approach.
So is there a specific amount of buffer that you're looking for? I mean, you could drop that weight and you could look at the chart and see how much margin you have then from there? Is there a tipping point? I know you've talked about in the past having a 50% buffer over what the POH says.
Yeah, I think that 50% buffer is reasonable. I remember, you know, we did some test with an actual, it wasn't a V35, it was an A36 Bonanza. But it's like, it doesn't make its book numbers. You know, those test pilots in Wichita flying new airplanes and getting, you know, unlimited chances to do it in the shortest, you know, have the best outcome possible. They achieved something that I couldn't do just, you know, trying my level best on a, you know, on a sort of standard day. So I've got a deep skepticism of Part 91 POHs. You know, the Part 25 ones, those are actually pretty darn accurate. You know, as Catherine was pointing out, that this was a sort of confidence built from previous experience. And, the pilot doesn't have that confidence or that previous experience in this plane or this situation. So it's like, I think, set an abort point, try with a partial load, see how that works.
I'll stick with you for one more question, Dave. You're going to have a conversation with the passengers here then, too, where they say, wait, we're splitting up and going back one at a time? Oh, yeah, because I'm concerned we might hit the trees if we all go together. I'm sure that's not exactly how you're going to handle it.
Yeah, but, you know, but it's like if it's being done out as an abundance of caution, and you can say that hey, the book numbers show this should be easily achievable. But because you want to be even safer than that, you're going to do it this way. And, you know, it just, that does not strike me as unreasonable.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Catherine.
Yeah, I've actually, I could be on board with 3 asterisk. Years ago, I was headed to Florida with my 2 kids, and I didn't really feel like I had the performance that left me, you know, feeling good leaving my home airport. So I actually drove them down to the airport, down the plateau, which is longer and such, dropped them off, came back, took off in my plane, picked them up, and, you know, it all worked out. So I've certainly done a version of that. It would be a function of this pilot needing to have some familiarity with the connection between, you know, the book performance and, reality. So the idea that you're going to say, put them in one at a time and take them, I think that could certainly work. But again, I think it still needs to be tied to some, you know, connection between the POH and performance.
And you can start with the most expendable person.
John.
I think we're all dancing around the same thing here, and that's weight. My choice for 5, which was basically to unload everything and fly empty to another airport where you could manage to get the people, whether they had to be driven or whatever. But we're all circling around the same thing. And if you look at the takeoff distance charts, all the takeoff distance charts have 3 variables, basically. There's the density altitude, which is in this chart, outside air temperature and pressure. We don't have the altimeter setting, but we can approximate it. Weight and wind. We can't do anything about the wind because it is what it is, and there's no wind. We've got 2 different choices on the density altitude, which would be either take off now at 1:30 in the afternoon when it's 90 degrees, or tomorrow morning when it's 60 degrees, or reduce the weight. And the slider that gives us the biggest bang for the buck here is reducing the weight. If you get down to just the pilot, the airplane's down to about 2,700 pounds. You're only going to need about 700 feet to clear that obstacle. It's going to take off much better. So that's why waiting for the next morning is really not going to get you very much. It only gets you about 200-foot reduction by the lowering the temperature to 60 degrees, assuming 60 degrees the next morning, as opposed to 90 in the afternoon. So the only way out of there basically is reducing the weight, and you got to get rid of the passengers one way or the other, whether you do them one at a time or find somebody to either fly them or drive them over to that Land O'Lakes airport. It's only about a 50-minute drive, so that's doable, which would be much easier than trying to convince everyone to spend the night with no preparation in some sort of cabin.
David.
Pro tip. Your emergency bag should have a bottle of a good adult beverage. That way, when you're trying to you know, borrow somebody's cabin, you've got something to offer.
There you go. But JP, you're going to wait until possibly the next morning or possibly when it gets cooler. What's going to make that decision for you?
You know, the more I hear about this, though, I think I'm wavering on this answer. And I like the idea of, which was not originally in the scenario, but kind of splitting the load there and reducing the number of people leaving, because really that difference in temperature is not going to be that much more dramatic. And the pilot has gotten themselves kind of in a pickle here through their poor flight planning. I think the lesson learned here is let's plan better on the front side so we do not get in this very inconvenient and even somewhat embarrassing type scenario where you're going to have to tell the passengers, well, I didn't run the numbers right. We need to go over here. The temperatures are a little bit too warm and we're too heavy. So I think that's the biggest lesson learned from here. But I like the idea of separating the passengers.
So we've got a lot of variations on the choices that we've presented. Paul, you don't like any of them.
Yeah, they all suck. And I guess the point I would make is that based on history, and we know this, every year we put a bunch of airplanes into trees and rocks and mountains related to poor performance, unpredicted performance, density, altitude, wind, and any number of factors. So in this scenario, and I realize I'm going off the reservation here a little bit, but humor me. What are we getting? Why are we doing this? So we're taking people, we're taking innocent passengers into a little grass strip for a stack of pancakes. That's the apparent benefit here. And so my reticence is that you're making the risk assessment for them because they know squat about what's going on here. They trust you, get this airplane in there and get it out. And they don't know anything about performance. So you're making that assessment for them. And it's not like you found yourself in the rabbit hole. You put yourself in the rabbit hole because you didn't do the planning. So now all of these options, to me, they're so full of uncertainty as to be not options at all. So in this situation, if I were with another pilot, perhaps, or anyone in this group who really knows what the score is and has a sense of performance, well, yeah, that's different. But you've got passengers, innocent passengers, who don't know anything. So do the planning and don't put them in this situation for a stack of pancakes.
So we're totally going to lose our sponsorship from the annual Prickett Grooms fly-in, by the way. but Paul, you are here now. I accept that you wouldn't have made this mistake. But suppose, you know, you swap places with this pilot and you're here. I take it you probably would wait for the cooler temperatures in the morning.
Well, John pointed out the cooler temperatures are not going to get you much because if it's 90 degrees, this is Michigan. So if it's 90 degrees in the afternoon, very unlikely it's going to be 60 in the morning. More likely it's going to be maybe 70. So you're really not gaining much there. And I think, you know, if you held my feet to the fire, which I think you are doing in a polite kind of way, I would explain to the people that we have to split the load here because I screwed up the planning, but it'll be fine. And I'll take you out in two loads. And that to me is not ideal because it just shows a lack of forethought. And if you're going to do general aviation safety, I mean, the first thing you need is forethought. And so that didn't happen here.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I guess that makes me kind of a reluctant choice for number five. Splitting the load was what?
Well, we don't have that exact answer on there. So okay. you would take off using either three or four, but with the caveat that you're
And then go to an airport, drop them off, and go get the rest. I mean, that would be the probably the most organized goat rope.
Yeah, well, with another option we didn't give you is to disassemble the plane, put it on a truck, and everybody drive home.
I'd leave that to John.
Yeah.
John.
So to back up Paul's point about the pre-flight planning, If you look at the notes for this airport in the AFD, there's actually something I've never seen before. It says, and I'll quote from it here, there's an area 60 feet either side of the runway centerline and 240 feet off each end suitable for reducing risk of aircraft damage in the event aircraft runs off runway. I've never seen that before. They actually documented a suitable area for reducing risk of aircraft damage.
That's crazy. So, I mean, it's yeah. It's like saying, yeah, you probably have a wreck here, but if you point it in this direction, yeah. Insurance company probably won't total it.
So you have an out after all.
Yeah.
Where are you seeing that, plus, John? I don't see it in the chart supplement.
It's in Sky Vector under the airspace notes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So take it for what it's worth. The other note that's in there that's interesting too is that it says the runway is soft when wet. In our setup, we said that the rain went through, the grass is dried in the sun, but that doesn't mean that it's not mushy underneath, you know, which is going to add even more to our lower performance.
Catherine.
Yeah, so if you look at that takeoff distance calculation, as John mentioned, it gives you three main components, ingredients into takeoff distance, which is basically density, altitude, weight, and then winds. So I agree in terms of trying to assess what matters most. I agree that weight is certainly, the biggest bang for the buck if you can reduce the weight. I'm going to go back to saying one thing about taking off in the morning, and this is just, you know, this certain day could end up not being this way, but generally speaking, if I take off in really calm situations like the morning, I have more predictable takeoff performance because of the lack of vertical movement of the air. So I think that's another, benefit to taking off in the morning is that you just have, less, generally speaking, less vertical air movement. And I think that that would help.
Dave.
You know, Paul's absolutely right in talking about how this is a predictable situation. And this pilot has really boxed himself in by electing to come there in the first place. And but I would say that so much of general aviation is working with compromised situations. You know, seldom in my life do things go exactly as planned. And, I often find myself in the position of trying to make the best out of, an imperfect situation. You know, I think the thing to look at here is, you know, does the POH say that you can do it? Yes, it does. Do you know to be skeptical of about the POH? Of course. And, and think about ways to mitigate bad situations. This is very much an art. And, and making these sorts of judgment calls is never easy. This is a particularly difficult one. And it's, granted, this is not a national emergency that they had to go here at this time. And certainly, weather and other information was available to them beforehand. But once this pilot's in this situation, it's that pilot's job to, use some better judgment and try to mitigate these adversities as best as possible.
David.
I think there was a lot of discussion around performance data, but to me, the huge takeaway is I can deal with a short field. I can deal with a soft field. But as soon as I see soft and short, huge spiny senses start tingling. You know, if this was a paved runway, I think any reasonable pilot should be able to operate out of that in the conditions given. If it was 5,000 feet long and grass and soft, then I think it would be completely reasonable to attempt a takeoff. But as soon as you saw short and soft, that frankly should have been the showstopper right there. And there's a few other things that I think are important to point out. The resources has a video of an airplane taking off, and it feels quite rough. And you notice the airplane bounces quite a bit. So it's not like these short field takeoffs this fellow was used to on the hard field. The airplane is going to be bouncing it's probably going to bounce in the air before it's ready to fly and then settle back down. So the temptation is to pull back a bit more. So there's many ways where this can go quite badly wrong. And so I think the there wasn't enough I would suggest this pilot did not think about the reality of operating from unimproved strips, which are often quite rough. And then finally, if you do decide to give up, my experience on wet grass is it can be quite slippery. And also, you can get soft spots. When I was flying out of the Yukon, we were operating our Grumman trackers and out of an airfield. And it turned out it had this big soft patch. And just before rotation, the main wheel got dragged into this on one side, and the airplane made this massive lurch to the side. And I almost went off the side of the runway. So there's many ways where these soft field takeoffs can go badly. And finally, one of the questions that nobody ever seems to ask is, what's a short field? And so, early in my flight career, somebody asked me that, and I said, well, what, it's short. Yeah, but what's short? And so it got me thinking about it, and so I arrived at, which I think is a pretty conservative approach. So you take the POH takeoff distance, you add a 3-second reaction time, so 75 knots is 125 feet per second, so 400 feet, say, and then you look at the stop time from the POH data, right? If the runway is shorter than those three numbers combined, then it's a short field, and you need to think about the so what's. And so, if you, as was pointed out, there is a massive lack of pre-flight planning here. But I also think if you have not operated off a unimproved strip, then don't do it on a short one as your first try, which appears to be the case here. Like, this is a disaster. And as Paul pointed out, which I think is really important, is how is this going to end badly? Flying speed, nose up into the trees, 50 feet in the air. Like, that's how people die. So we just don't want to go there. And I guess I've kind of modified my choice, maybe one asterisk. Maybe the safest approach here is to wait for the morning and then split the load, which gives you the most options. And also, I think it's important that Catherine's comment about the 70-50, this is one of the many flight school-isms that makes my head explode. It just gets mindlessly passed down from instructor to instructor without any intellectual rigor behind it. And so, yet it's taken as fact. And, I think, as she pointed out, it really isn't. So I think, you roll all this together and ask yourself, okay, well, I shouldn't have gone there for like five different reasons. Okay, I'm stuck there. What do I do now? What is the absolute safest thing I can do? Wait till the next morning when it's cooler, the air's calm, offload one of your passengers, and then stage them.
Let me just put in a point for the 70-50 rule, because nobody seems to like it. A friend of mine is a missionary pilot in East Africa, and their company SOP is to use the 70-50 rule. And it's not 50% of the full runway available, it's 50% of the expected ground roll. And two things that really allows them to do. One is it's an abort from a slower speed. So on a day like this, aborting from full takeoff speed, when you really need to stop, you're really running out of runway, and the grass might be wet or soft. If you were aborting from, say 40 knots instead of 60 knots, that could make a big difference. The other thing it does is it allows shorter runways, which they need for that sort of operation, because you're not counting on having enough runway to stop at takeoff speed. So that's what they do. Catherine, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, if that's been successful for them, then it's pure luck, because that rule is just not grounded in any sort of reasonable science. Here's something that could skew it. My home airport is the runway is not flat. It sort of goes up and down. It sort of undulates if you look at it from the side. So, and most runways have some sort of a slope to it. And in particular, if they're using this on mission trips and these backcountry kinds of strips, then, it's just completely unrealistic to think that runway is going to be flat. So, the rule doesn't even make any scientific sense, but it really, really doesn't make sense if you're now not talking about a flat runway. So I just, I wish that rule would go away.
Dave.
I just want to put in a shameless plug for the mighty V-tailed Bonanza, because just a quick anecdote. I was at this Super Cub fly-in where there were Super Cubs, Huskies, 185s, a bunch of really, really brawny, macho backcountry airplanes in Montana. And, you know, and we're all there in our, we've got our spot trackers and our survival vests and all these, all the accessories for backcountry flying. And while we were there, in comes this V-35 V-tail Bonanza with the parents and the kids in the back, and makes a beautiful landing and came and went several times during this this event. And really impressed me with the quite substantial off-field or non-paved runway capabilities of this sort of stodgy old plane.
Yeah, Bonanzas will do that. I mean, a well-flown Bonanza, but a lot of them don't. Not related to the airplane itself, but you know, on the subject of aborts, you can pencil it out and you can do all the calculations you want, but I mean, how many pilots have actually practiced an abort? I had a few of them when I was flying twins for Part 135 check rides. But other than that, we really didn't do them once. And an abort is another aviation skill. You know, you have to get the power off and get the braking and know where to do it and do it in a disciplined, accurate way. And as far as the abort on this particular runway, I think there's a almost unavoidable temptation to, you get to the abort point and say, well, it's actually looking pretty good now. I think I got it. And then you don't got it and you either run off into the preordained crash areas John found, or you drag it off and you wind up in the rocks or the trees. So yeah, great. If you're going to do aborts, practice them, know what they're like, you know, have the abort point well-defined and know when to recognize it and do it. Otherwise, you're just doing it in the moment. And in this case, you're doing it with two or three innocent passengers. Not a good thing.
Yeah, these missionary pilots I mentioned, they do know their planes and they practice it religiously, so to speak. David.
As I'm sure they would.
Yeah, I think the missionary pilots, it almost relates back to the role reversal scenario where pilot skill is going to have a large determinant in success or not. But I think one of the things, too, is sort of rolling back the beginning of the takeoff, what's the pilot going to see? Well, first of all, the nose is going to be up, right? Because it's soft field, so he wants to keep the nose wheel out of the dirt. So the airplane's going to come off at minimum flying speed. And there's going to be a windshield full of trees not too far away. And yet, what you're going to have to do is actually pitch forward briefly to get to the VX speed, retract the gear, and then pitch up. The temptation to raise the nose, I think, is going to be strong. And now the airplane is going to be slow and wobbling. And so what could have been a perfectly safe takeoff by someone with lots of experience like Catherine could just as easily be a very sad outcome. And so I think, again, if you roll back to where we're starting from and what the experience level of the pilot is, you're only as good as you are on the day. So in this situation, has this pilot ever experienced anything similar? And I would argue no. So there's no experience base to base it on, whereas a missionary pilot, they do that 8 times a day. That's a huge difference.
Yeah, there's no experience to base it on. The numbers they're looking at from the book are for short field technique off pavement, but now it's a soft field, or is it a soft field? You don't really know how soft, and you've maybe not experienced that. Do you go back to your private pilot training and the full-on soft field technique? Do you do a short field takeoff? Do you do some sort of hybrid thing? These are all things that should have been practiced and understood beforehand, before you get to a point where you're trying to tell your passengers that they need to stay behind so you don't hit the trees, or before you do actually fly them into the trees.